Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and now let's talk about what's being called one of the greatest scientific discoveries of the past century. It has to do with this, a little sound revealed to the world today.
That's the chirp we've been looking for.
And that's Dr. Gabriela Gonzalez there at the end, barely able to contain her excitement. So let's listen again.
Whoop. That's the chirp we've been looking for.
That little chirp, that tiny little whoop, is the astounding sound of two black holes colliding. An astronomical cataclysm that happened a billion years ago, releasing... And here's why there's so much excitement. Gravitational waves. Ripples in space-time theorized by Einstein a century ago, but never directly observed until now.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have detected gravitational waves. We did it.
That's Dr. David Reitze, executive director of the LIGO Laboratory. The worldwide LIGO team includes researchers from MIT, whom we'll speak with in a moment. But first, let's underscore something. Today's announcement has Nobel Prize written all over it. That's what people in the scientific community are saying. And why? Well, to start, it confirms the wildest reaches of Einstein's imagination. Moreover, well, here's how LIGO director David Reitze puts it.
400 years ago, Galileo turned a telescope to the sky and opened the era of modern observational astronomy. I think we're doing something equally important here today. I think we're opening a window on the universe, the window of gravitational wave astronomy.
Well, joining us now is a member of the LIGO team, MIT professor of astrophysics Nirgis Mavalvala. Professor Mavalvala, welcome to Radio Boston, and a deep congratulations to you.
Thank you, Meghna. I'm a big fan. I can't believe I'm talking to you.
The feeling is entirely mutual. I can't believe I'm talking to you. Well, joining us also in the studio, we have a professor of physics at MIT, Scott Hughes. Professor Hughes, welcome to you.
Thank you. I'm also a big fan.
There is a mutual circle of fandom, but I'm going to put myself right here at the bottom because Professor Mavalvala, it's you and the LIGO team that have made a discovery that is rippling around the world in terms of its consequences. So first of all, how are you feeling today?
Completely ecstatic, and you know, we're very aware of the work that still lies ahead of us, but this is just fantastic.
Okay, so explain to us more, those of us who are not astrophysicists by day, what exactly is a gravitational wave?
So a gravitational wave is just what you've been calling it. It's a ripple in space-time. So one of the things Einstein taught us was that empty space, you know, space that's just empty and dark, it still has certain properties. And among the things that empty space can do is it can warp and curve and ripple. And so these are ripples of the space-time itself. And these are waves or ripples that travel on the space-time fabric, very much the same way as a ripple would travel on the surface of a pond if you dropped a rock in it.
Okay. Now, you helped design the instruments that allowed astrophysicists to detect these gravitational waves for the first time. I want to play a little bit of tape here to describe how monumental even just the ability to measure this is. And this is tape from MIT Professor Emeritus Rainer Weiss. He's one of the founders of LIGO, which, by the way, LIGO means Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. And here he is describing the size of the fluctuations that LIGO is trying to measure.
Start with a meter and divide it by a million three times over. First time you divide it, you get a micron. So 10 to the minus 6. That's sort of the size of a cell, or maybe the thousandth of your hair. Well, you've got much more to go. Then you divide by another million, and now you're at 10 to the minus 12. That's about 1/100th the size of an atom, and you're still not there. And now you divide again by another million, and you get to this number that we have to measure.
I have to say, Professor Mavalvala, it bends my mind to think that two black holes colliding a billion light years away produce a wave that we can finally measure that's that tiny. It sounds virtually impossible. I mean, how did you approach this?
Yeah, so it is virtually impossible, but just it's virtually that makes the difference here. So what we do is we use something called a laser interferometer, and what we really do is we take a laser beam And we let it travel out to a mirror. It reflects on the mirror and comes back to us. And what we really are doing is we're measuring the travel time of that laser beam. Now, if a gravitational wave comes through, what happens is it actually changes the distance between our laser and the mirror at the other end of the detector, which happens to be, by the way, 2.5 miles long. And so as the gravitational wave comes through, the space between the laser and the mirror changes by that tiny amount that Professor Weiss just told us about, by a meter divided by a million three times over, so 10 to the minus 18 meters. That, by the way, has a name. It's called an attometer, for anybody who wants to learn a cool new term. And so what we have to do is we have to make sure that the mirrors of our detectors are held very, very still. Now, everything on the planet wants to move the mirror more than this gravitational wave that's coming by. So, yeah, you know, vibrations, earthquakes, all of those things are shaking the mirrors. And so what we do is we do something called vibration isolation. And the concept of vibration isolation is very similar to the shock absorbers in your car.
Uh-huh.
You either use springs or you use pendulums. We happen to use pendulums. And when you do that, you actually can get the mirror to be shielded from these forces.
Well, Professor Mavalvala, if you could just hold on there for just 1 second, because I don't want to run out of too much time before we hear from Professor Hughes here. Scott Hughes, you've been working on gravitational waves for, what, a couple decades now as well.
I'm not quite that old, but I've been... I started in this field in 1993. I guess it is a couple decades, isn't it? So I started as a PhD student in Kip Thorne's group in 1993.
So can you describe to us then why this is such an exciting discovery? What exactly does that little whoop in that sound of the gravitational wave, what kind of door is it opening for us?
I mean, there's so many things we can say about this. So part of what makes these gravitational waves so hard to measure, as Nurgis was starting to outline, you know, we have such small effects, that arises fundamentally because gravity is a very weak force. Okay? You can lift a cup of coffee off of your table. When you do that, a little bit of force from your muscles is overcoming the attraction of the rest of the entire planet. It's really easy for small things to mess it up. And that makes these things really hard to detect, which is a curse. But it also means that when these waves are generated and they propagate out across the universe, they barely interact with anything else, which is a blessing, because it's telling you that if you can actually measure these things, you're getting a very unimpeded view, or as we like to think of it, an unimpeded listen to the dynamics of whatever that process is that generates these things.
Wow. So you mentioned Dr. Kip Thorne. In fact, he was quoted in an email that he sent to the New York Times, and he said basically what LIGO has observed was, in his words, a storm in which the flow of time speeded, then slowed, then speeded again, a storm with space bending this way and that. And the power of this observation, I mean, what are the next questions then that science needs to start asking?
So, again, as I say, there's so many things we could go into. Part of what is going on, what is Kip is describing there, is the fact that when we observe these things, there is strong field dynamics described by Einstein's theory of general relativity, in which we are looking at really strong gravitational fields oscillating and vibrating in a way that we have never probed before. For me, part of what was so stunning about seeing the data we had that was just made public today is that we take the equations that Einstein originally wrote down in 1915, you know, essentially you make a computer program based on them. You say, I'm going to start with two black holes, and I'm going to ask what happens to them when they merge together. You just take the output of that computer program, and they line up exactly with what came out of these detectors.
Yeah.
Now, I should emphasize that actually writing that computer program, that is a multi-decade process that consumed theorists for years and years and years until it finally succeeded about 10 years ago. But now that we have that technology, we can run the computer programs. We can look at how things vary as we change the parameters of the black holes and how they interact with one another. And what we've already seen with this one event is Einstein's 1915 formulation of general relativity nails the data.
So, Professor Mavalvala, I'm going to turn back to you for a second, speaking of Einstein. But I want to just play one last piece of tape from David Reitze, head of the LIGO team, who described in almost poetic terms what exactly LIGO observed.
Take something that's 150 kilometers in diameter. So that's about a little bit bigger, maybe a lot bigger than the metropolitan Washington, D.C. area. Pack 30 times the mass of the sun in that. accelerate it to about half the speed of light. Now take another thing, 30 times the mass of the sun, accelerate it half the speed of light, and collide them together. That's what we saw here. It's mind-boggling.
Mind-boggling indeed. We should say, though, that this is science, and so, you know, in order for this to become, you know, part of the bedrock foundation of science, it needs to go through confirmation, and the results have to be replicable. Those things still must happen. But Professor Mavalvala, I do have to ask you a question that jumps off what Professor Hughes was just saying. Einstein theorized this a century ago. It seems as if you and the LIGO team have now confirmed Einstein's imagination. Just that simple fact, how does that feel?
It's fantastic. I think it's taken 100 years because it was really hard to do. The technologies just weren't available until recently. But now they're here, and this is just the start. This is just the first ripple we've been able to detect. These detectors are going to get better, and we're just going to listen to more and more music from the universe.
Music from the universe. Is that what it sounds like to you, Scott Hughes?
Yeah. Every one of these things is a little song. And every one of these little songs has encoded with it a message that tells me about the singers. In this case, the singers are these black holes. And I expect as we listen more, we're going to hear a lot more songs. We're going to hear a lot more about the singers. And just going to learn more and more about the wonderful things that are out there for us to listen to.
Well, let's listen to that music one more time before we wrap up.
That's the chirp we've been looking for.
Gravitational waves, everybody. Dr. Nirgis Mavalvala, professor of astrophysics at MIT. She helped design the instruments that allowed physicists to detect gravitational waves for the first time, thereby confirming the wildest corners of Einstein's imagination. Dr. Mavalvala, thank you so very much, and congratulations again.
Thank you very much, Magna.
And Dr. Scott Hughes, professor of physics at MIT. He's been studying gravitational waves as well for many years. Dr. Hughes, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And too bad, now that we know gravitational waves exist, we can't quite bend space-time yet to stretch out this show a little bit longer. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.